Dear Loaf listeners, I hope you're all well. Today's episode is with Dr. Frans de Waal, a renowned primatologist, a prolific author, but most importantly, a kind and amazing man. We were very lucky to speak with him shortly before he passed, only in March, so very recently, after he lost his battle with cancer. We'll be leaving some links down below to donate to cancer research. We want to let you know that our thoughts are with his family at this time. Please enjoy the episode.
This is the Loaf Podcast. Welcome back to the bakery, everyone, where we break bread with the world's finest. Today, we're very lucky to be joined by Frans de Waal. He's one of the most foremost primatologists in the world and a prolific author, teaching us all we can learn about ourselves from our nearest relatives, primates. Frans, thanks so much for being with us here today.
You're welcome.
How are you?
I'm all right under the circumstances. I'm okay. Under treatment of some chemo treatment, but I'm able to talk and think. I'm clear-headed. Yep,
that's good, and we're glad you could join us today. Thank you very much. Now, before we get into your research and work, we like to ask all our guests a nice simple question. We like to ask what our guests' favorite bread is. You know, bread is the sustenance of life. And it usually tells us a little bit about a person.
I make my own bread, sourdough bread.
Nice.
Yeah, and there's, I do add a little bit of yeast to it, I must say. So I'm cheating, so to speak.
Cheating a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, but I make a nice bread, and it has all sorts of flours in it and nuts and stuff like that.
Yeah, we had Peter Singer on the podcast. I'm sure you know he is. He also bakes his own bread. So it's interesting. What the bread bakers of academia?
Yeah, the situation in the US is that the bread is not good. It's not as good as not as good as in Germany, Holland, or France, where you have real bakers. It's harder to get here, and so. My idea is that the bigger revolution here, after the coffee and the beer, and the wine, which was greatly improved in the US, they need a bread revolution.
It's only anecdotal, but I've heard a lot of stories of American people moving to Europe, mm-hmm. and they find their health improves loads and they lose weight, etc. And supposedly a lot of it has to do with the manner of bread production and how it's just not as good for you, because the FDA food regulations and whatnot are a lot looser.
And it's also the amounts. You get smaller amounts in Europe.
Yeah, that's true. So moving on from that serious topic, let's have some fun with it. So for those who aren't so familiar with your work, you're probably best known around the world for the way you relate your studies in primatology to humans and what we can learn. But could you just give a little introduction to some key elements maybe of your work and what you've worked at in your career?
Well, initially, my main interest was the animals themselves. So I didn't care much about the comparison with humans, even though when Desmond Morris' book, The Naked Ape, came out, that became an issue. That became something that people started to think about. But I discovered that the chimpanzees that I studied had political strategies. And so I wrote my first book was Chimpanzee Politics. And even though I mentioned barely any humans in there, some political scientists got extremely upset that the term politics was used for animals, even though now we use it for dolphins and hyenas and I don't know what. But they had very highfalutin ideas about what politics is, until I met an older political scientist who said, we define politics as who gets when, what, and how. Well, if that's the definition, then chimpanzee politics is all about who gets what. The females or the food or whatever. So my colleagues were not reacting to the term politics. They thought it was fine because I think they knew what I was talking about. But the social scientists were unhappy about it. And this is sort of the story of my life, is each time you propose something, someone's going to be very unhappy about it. If you say that chimpanzees reconcile or that they have empathy or that they cooperate, all these things were taboo at some point.
Yeah, I read your book, Different. And yeah, one of the key things you talk about actually is how language is one of the most contentious things in this field of study. So we'll get onto that with gender and sexuality later. But what do you think, and language is just one part of that, what do you think the methodology should be when applying these insights from close relative primates, as you do in your later books? And what do you think we should be wary of?
Yeah, there were usually a lot of warnings about anthropomorphism. We should avoid anthropomorphism, which was a way of saying, keep humans out of it. Talk about animals, but don't use human terminology because it confuses us. And my attitude was, humans are animals. And if you take a close relative like the chimpanzee and you say the chimpanzee is jealous, I don't see why you cannot say that, or the chimpanzee is in a good mood or in a bad mood. All these things we should be able to say, but there was a taboo on that. And so the comparisons that I've made are between, let's say, politics or morality in humans and animals, basically going back to Darwin, because Darwin did the same thing. And then we entered in the previous century, what I call the Dark Ages, when Skinner ruled and declared animals machines, stimulus response machines. And so we moved from a time that you could talk about animal emotions to a time that it was taboo.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you bring up morality, because a lot of your work is arguing for the fact that humans, through the research you do with primates, proving that humans are inherently moral. I was wondering if you could maybe elucidate on that and give us some examples of animal behavior that prove this kind of inherent morality in species.
Well, it started with my work on empathy. So in chimpanzees, for example, but also in bonobos and some other species, elephants, for example, if someone is distressed because they have been attacked or they have seen a snake or whatever it is, then others come over and embrace them and kiss them and calm them down. I call that consolation. In the 1990s, I met a woman who studied empathy in children. And from that time on, I called it empathy, because that's exactly what she was measuring. She was measuring how children respond to the distress of others. Now, once you say animals have empathy, which we now say freely, but at the time was controversial, you enter the domain of morality. According to the Dalai Lama, all you need for morality is compassion. He said, you cannot go wrong with compassion, which is probably true. But empathy is absolutely central. How could you have a moral system in human society if you don't particularly care about people? If you're not affected by their emotions, you don't care their situation. So empathy is absolutely a core capacity of human morality. Human morality goes beyond that, in that we make rules and principles, and so there's a cognitive overlay, but the basic emotions are similar.
Yeah, I mean, Iris Murdoch says that what underlines morality is this idea of attention and loving attention, and I think the recognition of another person is really crucial to morality.
Yeah, because without it, what do you have? You have probably a psychopath who can act morally, but is it really interested in you?
Something that really struck me in your work as well is the idea of how evolution kind of creates these impulses. So, for example, evolution creates the impulse of empathy to serve an evolutionary function, that is, to bind the group and whatnot. But then that impulse exists in its own right, and we shouldn't see it as evolution going wrong. So, like, for example, the example you use of people saving a whale and pushing it back into sea should be seen really as like a positive byproduct of evolution rather than as like an unnecessary thing that comes out of it.
Yeah. Certainly empathy did not evolve to take care of whales in the ocean. We can be sure of that. And if these people were hungry, they would do something else with the veil, I'm sure. So dependent on the circumstances, we can use empathy for all sorts of purposes. We can empathize even with our enemies. It's something I'm sure was not the origin of empathy. But once a capacity exists, it becomes available for all sorts of other things. So, for example, the sexuality of bonobos. Sex, of course, originally is there to reproduce, but they use it for all sorts of other purposes. So once it is there, you can do that, yeah.
Yeah, and I think we'll move on to sex, gender, and sexuality at one point and a little bit later. But first, before we do, just to stay on morality for a second, in our research, we came across the term veneer theory and your veneer theory. And as someone who studied Hobbes at secondary school and sixth form, I was wondering if you could outline your veneer theory and perhaps why you disagree with it.
Yeah, I get credited for the term veneer theory as if I agree with it, which is not the case.
Yeah, exactly.
Because for me, it's a sort of insult. It's like the biologists at the time in the 70s and 80s, they said we cannot be truly kind. We cannot be truly altruistic. Scratch an altruist and watch a hypocrite bleed. That was the expression at the time. So real kindness was fake, didn't exist in nature. And that was the sort of the slogan that they had. And I called it veneer theory. I said, our morality is just a thin veneer underneath of which we are extremely selfish and have all sorts of brutal instincts. It's very Freudian, but, you know, Freud had the same ideas about human civilization. It's just an overlay. But underneath, we are selfish monsters, basically. So I call that veneer theory. And it was intended as an insult, but people now credit me for it, yeah.
Yeah, so as far as I understand, just to for our audience who might not be very familiar with your work, do you disagree with the veneer theory because you believe that animals, humans, bonobos, chimpanzees, are inherently moral, and this isn't to do with religion, but is something that is, in some sense, biological?
Yeah. All animals, social animals, including humans, have very strong helping tendencies and empathic tendencies that are aimed at their friends and family. So it is very parochial. It doesn't usually extend beyond the group, but it's how the group survives. Because if my best buddy is wounded and cannot keep up with me, I'm going to slow down my movement. So that's the first act of empathy that you can do. And that's absolutely essential if you want to maintain relationships. And so we are inherently competitive and selfish. We're also inherently cooperative and kind. And empathy is an automatic response. In the beginning, when people studied empathy in humans, they had a very high-level cognitive explanation, like empathy is putting yourself in the shoes of others, understanding others, theory of mind, stuff like that. But now we know that empathy is an automatic response. It comes up even unconsciously. So you're sitting with someone who is in a sad mood, you're going to be expressing sadness too. So automatically, you don't even think about it.
Yeah, for me, it's interesting the differences between particularly primate and human empathy. I think I hesitate to make a strong distinction, but I think a little leap has been made where I watched a documentary on Netflix. I'm not sure if you've seen it, Chimp Empire, talking about documenting the Ngogo chimpanzees. And they do have empathy within their tribe effectively, but absolutely none and violent behavior when it comes to the opposing tribe.
Oh, yeah.
So I was wondering what you think, maybe how and why that leap has been made in humans. Do you think that's the develop like cognitive development and so then adding the cognitive element to empathy, or what do you think like might be under that?
Yeah, there's the in-group out-group distinction is found mm-hmm. in all animals, and in chimpanzees it's very violent. In bonobos it's non-violent. They're equally close to us, but they don't have these territorial wars that the chimps have. So yeah, there's very little empathy for outside the group. And I think humans originally were like that too. What happened with human morality is that it has a reasoning component. And so we say, if people have dignity and we need to treat people well, what about our enemies? Shouldn't it also apply to our enemies? And so the Geneva Conventions, for example, they're absolutely astonishing, because that's not something a chimpanzee would ever do, treat your enemies well. So that's a human advancement of morality, I would say.
Yeah, it's interesting that you speak about enemies, because in your latest book, there's an anecdote that you mention where two male chimps who are normally sworn enemies have their arms around each other, kind of forming this barricade between a newborn and this alpha male who might want to kill the newborn.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was wondering, these two, even in chimps, for example, I think that maybe sworn enemies can come together even in specific circumstances.
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. And if you introduce chimps to each other in captivity, so these are animals who don't know each other at all, there is initially a lot of tension, especially in the males, but in the end they will become friends and they will do things together. So yeah, they can overcome the strangeness of the other, yeah.
I wonder if part of something I learned as well from that documentary, I wonder if part of the protective instinct for that child of them coming together is the fact that chimps actually don't know which exact chimp is their child or not their child. So like in terms of the gene development, there might have been a development to protect all the children, because that's potentially pushing your own personal genome maybe.
Yeah, and some animals keep track of who they mated with. So they may not know about paternity and kinship, but they are protective of the young of females they have mated with, which is an indirect way of protecting your own offspring, of course. And it's very well possible that in that case of the two males who protected the newborn, that they had mated with the female, and the other male who was aggressive and obnoxious, that he never mated with the female. That's possible.
To bring this back to one of your experiments, because I think one of the things that you're most famous for is obviously your experiments, which have often gone viral for the relatively astounding results. There's one experiment which really struck me, where you have two monkeys and one of the monkeys gets a cucumber and the other gets a grape. And obviously these monkeys, I think they were capuchin monkeys, but correct me if I was wrong. One gets a grape and they obviously prefer grapes. And the one who gets a cucumber gets really annoyed, gets pissed off and throws the cucumber at the person conducting the experiment because they feel there's inequity. And I was wondering, you know, what does this tell us about primates, and to what extent can this be applied to humans?
Yeah, so when Sarah Brosnan and I did this experiment on capuchin monkeys, which is the most watched animal experiment on the internet, I think 200 million downloads or something like that. So, and that's because people recognize themselves. They see a monkey who gets shortchanged and it reacts aggressively, and they recognize that, because they have sometimes a salary that is too low or whatever it is. And this experiment, initially we called it inequity aversion, but the media immediately called it fairness, and it became an experiment on fairness. And initially there was a lot of doubt about it, but now we have maybe 40, 50 studies, maybe more, maybe 100 studies of this kind of phenomenon. And it occurs in many other species as well. Dogs and wolves, the chimpanzees. Chimpanzees go actually further than the monkeys. In the monkeys, the one who gets the cucumber gets upset, but the one who gets the grape doesn't care. In the chimpanzees, the one who gets the grape may wait till the other one also gets a grape before he eats it. So in chimpanzees, there's more concern about the relationship, I think, than in the capuchin monkeys.
I think it's a pretty strong biological basis for in I do philosophy, and kind of what people talk about as in throughout the history of philosophy, something that's constantly seen as like the golden rule of reciprocity. Like in the Bible, for example, do unto others as you would have done unto you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's basically probably like the basic biological root of that.
Yeah. The reciprocity rule is just as essential for human morality as the empathy. Those are the two pillars for me of human morality.
So I just want to move it on now to gender, if that's okay with you, because that I loved different. And I think you take quite a unique position in what's quite like a polarized discussion, which is either sex and gender are synonymous, and that's kind of the essentialist position. And then you have positions which take gender to be completely cultural, say positions such as Judith Butler's, who say gender's a performance. Could you just closely outline exactly how you think that interaction works for us? And then maybe we can talk about the basis and the reasons why you think that.
Well, the reason we have a gender duality is because we have two sexes. And so there's more than, because people say sex is binary and gender, of course, is not binary. Gender can be all over the place. Gender is usually divided in masculine, feminine, and everything in between. But sex is usually divided in male, female. But there is, of course, an intermediate category of maybe 1% or 2% of people who are not easily classified as male or female. So sex is biological, and gender cannot be completely independent of it. I think if we had no sexes, biological sexes, I don't think anyone would have come up with the concept of gender. So the gender is not a cultural construct. It's related to our biology, even though it gives you more freedom because it has more expressions and more variation than the sexes.
And I think I found your argument for, your argument, I'd say, against transphobia really interesting, because usually it relies often upon a cultural interpretation of gender, let's say. And I was wondering if you could outline, I really liked how you talked about how it's actually gender can be quite resistant to social norms in a lot of ways.
Yeah, so I describe in my book a female chimpanzee, Donna, who from the very beginning of her life acted a little bit like a male. And the older she got, the more she looked like a male, and she hung out with a male, and she intimidates others the way males do. And she was very well accepted in the group, even though she was quite different in her behavior. But she was not really violent, and I think the only thing chimps object to is individuals who are overly violent. For the rest, they are very tolerant of whatever variation exists. And so maybe Donna was trans. I cannot ask her how she identifies. But trans people, it's very small. It's less than 1% of the population. Trans people, it's probably a biological thing that happens in their brain. There is some evidence for that, is that the brain of, for example, a trans woman resembles more that of women than of men, even though she was born as a man. So we think there's a biological basis to it, and that in other primates we find a lot of gender diversity too, like homosexual behavior is extremely common. The bonobos are usually called bisexual because they don't particularly care about who they have sex with, it seems. So I think that same gender diversity we see in human society, if you look carefully, you're going to find it in other animals too.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of bonobos being bisexual for me is fascinating. But just to linger one more moment on the transgender conversation, And you mentioned the biological basis for transgenderism. And I think you talked, there's this study about the bed nucleus of the stria terminalis. And mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could explain that just a little bit, because for me, the idea of transgenderism being based and located in biology is revolutionary.
Yeah, so Dick Swaap, a Dutch neuroscientist who has also worked on homosexuality and the brain, he proposed that it's possible that during pregnancy, the fetus differentiates its genitals first in male and female, and its brain later in the pregnancy between male and female. And that these two processes sometimes get disconnected. So you end up with the genitals of one sex and the brain of another sex, which is what will cause you to be transgender. And so that's one of the biological theories that exists. There may be people who are influenced by others who are not truly transgender, but they're talked into it by others. There's, of course, a discussion in the US at the moment, and then they regret later. But if you look at the data on regret, it's very low. It's just a few percentage. So most kids who, at the age of, let's say, 4 or 5, say that they are, let's say it's a, born as a boy, and they say, I'm a girl, they don't return. They don't change their mind. They say, I'm a girl. From that moment on, they are a girl in their mind. And so this whole discussion has gotten out of hand, I think. And I understand that when it comes to sports, we have different issues. But that's a very specific and very small proportion of everything that's going on, I would say.
Another kind of aspect in which nature is used for what I would call kind of slightly right-wing reactionary views is as it relates to homosexuality and nature, and a lot of what you've written about is the denunciation of that. So can you tell us a little bit about your work with bonobos and why an argument that homosexuality is unnatural is basically crap?
Yeah. The bonobos, I would estimate 3/4 of their sexual activity has nothing to do with reproduction. It's all about social relationships. And so male-male, female-female, male youngster, female youngster, everything is possible. And they do that. And they have a very peaceful society as a result, which is interesting, I think. More sex, more peace. So, but now there are studies coming out also on chimpanzees and some other species. There are more and more studies coming out on homosexual behavior in other species. It's actually very common. It's usually not exclusive. Exclusive homosexuality doesn't really exist much in animals, I think, except in a few species. But in humans, we force people culturally to declare themselves this or that. So we force them in little boxes. But I'm not sure that most people fit these boxes. Even people who say that they are homosexual and that's all they are, I'm not sure they are 100% homosexual. And the same for heterosexuals. People say they're heterosexual. I'm not sure they have no erotic feelings for fellow men or fellow women. I'm not sure about that. And so Alfred Kinsley, the pioneer of sexology, he didn't believe that these boxes really existed. They were sort of a fabrication.
But do you think they serve, in terms of a cultural politics, do you think they serve a helpful function in terms of identifying people into categories? Or do you think we should be looking at more the erasure of categories and the normalization of people who would otherwise be considered largely heterosexual to, for example, have one homosexual relationship and so on?
Yeah. In the primates, there's a high level of tolerance. And of course, they don't label themselves. They're not symbolic. So they don't say, I'm this or I'm that. But there's an enormous level of... I've never actually heard that an individual who is more homosexual than heterosexual is ousted from a group or is attacked for that. So we could learn from that. And I think all these identity politics of I'm this and I'm that and I'm such and I'm so is not really productive, I would say. What we need is a society who cares less about these labels.
Yeah, I mean, why do you think there's such a... Well, often, at least in my experience, people who espouse beliefs against homosexuality base their argument in nature. So there's this argument, well, this fallacy where one appeals to nature. And it's so interesting to me that even that is wrong. Even in nature, we can see that homosexuality and bisexuality occurs without any kind of, I would say cultural nurturing. Although, as you've pointed out, that even within non-human animal societies, there is this mix of society and biology. So the nature nurture occurs even in non-human animals.
Yeah. We humans have a tendency to project our ideology on nature, mm-hmm. and then take it out and say that's where it comes from. So, for example, conservatives will depict nature as a place of combat and competition and selfishness. During the Reagan and Thatcher years, that's how nature was depicted. Greed was good, selfishness was good, because it all came from nature. But it's just a conservative projection of their ideology on nature.
Because you find... Sorry to interrupt, but I think it came because of chimps, right? Because people have this bias towards chimps, which are, I think, a bit more aggressive. So that made people think of humans as more aggressive.
Yeah, and that's why they didn't like the bonobos. Bonobos are equally close to us as chimps. And when they came along and we said the females are dominant and they're peaceful and they have a lot of sex, many anthropologists... were extremely unhappy with the bonobo and tried to marginalize them because their story of human evolution doesn't turn around peace. It turns about warfare and male bonding. So they had no room for the bonobo. Fortunately, that's changing because there's more and more women anthropologists also. So that whole field has changed now.
I was going to ask, I mean, so obviously... we sit in the primate category, just aside from monkeys. But the behavioral characteristics and the emotional characteristics, as like we've already, you know, kind of implicitly covered throughout the whole interview, chimps and bonobos being the best example, vary quite differently. Chimps are very aggressive, bonobos less so. Chimps are less sexual, bonobos more so. In terms of applying insights about primates to humans and understanding our own psychologies, How can we balance between these competing forces and sort of draw conclusions in like where we sit, so to speak?
Yeah, so nothing is simple. People want a simple story. And that's why many scientists were very happy with the chimp, because their story of violence and territoriality fit with the chimps. They're forgetting that this is all based on East African chimps. The West African chimps are not like that. So if you look at the data on violent encounters and killing among chimpanzees, you're going to end up with a lot in the East African chimps and very little in the West African chimps. So even within the chimps, there's variation dependent on the ecology probably and where they live. And then we have the bonobo. And so it makes for a much more complex picture. I think there are certain universals for humans and the primates, like males are more physically aggressive than females. Females are very attracted to the young. And from a very early age, if you give them dolls and trucks, the females pick up the dolls and the males pick up the trucks. So there's these studies of play behavior. There are some universal differences, but there's a lot of differences that people postulate that don't exist. Like they will say male make better leaders because they are dominant. Well, they're physically dominant, But there's a lot of female leadership in the primate groups, and they tend to forget that. Every primate group has an alpha female, and sometimes these individuals are extremely powerful.
I wanted to ask you about, returning to kind of our discussion about anthropomorphism, or the fallacy of saying, oh, that's anthropomorphism. Culture is one of those big things. Culture is seen, like language, to be uniquely human. And you kind of fight against that in your work. What are some of the manifestations of, for example, cultures that, little bits of culture that we see in primates just above biology?
Well, the reason that chimps and bonobos are so slow in their development, and the same is true for whales and elephants who are very slow in developing. So if a chimpanzee is adult when they're 16, humans are adult maybe when they're 20. So the slowness of development is because we need to learn a lot of things before we can be successful adults. But otherwise, nature doesn't like slow development. They don't like slow reproduction. So some animals have that, including the apes and humans. And that is because they need to learn so many things about what to eat, what not to eat, what to avoid, how to go about socially to be successful. All these things need to be learned.
Tool formation is another thing, I think, in anthropology that was postulated as one of the things that separated us out, as one of the first things where we started to kind of develop away from the naturally occurring animal world. You cited, right, that tool formation is actually very common in other primates as well.
And in birds, there are excellent studies now on corvids, you know, the crow family, and parrots, who can not just use tools, but you can give them material to make tools, and they do that. So that whole field of tool technology has completely changed.
Yeah, because I mean, you've got this idea when it comes to tools. I'm sure you've seen 2001 Space Odyssey, the idea that the dawn of man arrives when humans discover tools. And do you believe that that's kind of maybe a misconception?
Yeah, I would say so. I think human technology is very special, but not completely unique. So if I would rate the human, I would say socially and emotionally, we are primates. We're not particularly different from the primates. Technologically, because we're able to accumulate knowledge, you can read a book from the Middle Ages and learn something from it, which a chimp cannot do, because there are no books from the Middle Ages for them. So, that has changed everything. That's all cultural accumulation, especially in the last couple of thousand years. It is fairly new that we have things like cell phones and airplanes and stuff like that. But it's an accumulation. It's not a single individual who came up with the cell phone. The cell phone is a product of hundreds of years, thousands of years of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that, I know that you say that there's no kind of distinct line that separates humans and animals. But one thing that really kind of that shows this stark difference between humans and non-human animals or primates is language. Language seems to me something that allows humans to communicate between themselves and also to have more complex and reasoned out thoughts, because obviously species that don't have language cannot do that.
Yeah, no, language is very special. And we humans, we know how special it is. And we've tried to teach apes language, and it's not particularly successful, I would say. But I must add that if you would study human language the same way we study, let's say, whale song with sonograms and analysis of peak frequencies and stuff like that, human language would not come out as necessarily very different. If you don't know the symbolism that's behind it, it will sound very similar. And I would say that orcas or chimpanzees, when they communicate, there may be messages in there that we don't fully understand yet. And so it may be more complex than we think.
I think orcas is a key example. People talk about orcas and dolphins as being one of the two, dolphin being a mammal that potentially has like the strongest potential for language. I don't know where you sit on that debate.
Well, dolphins call each other by name. So they have signature vessels. Each individual has its own signature and they recognize them each other by that. But if they want the attention of a particular individual, they may mimic their whistle, which is basically calling them by their name. So I think we underestimate a lot of the animal communication still, and I think that picture will change. But really symbolic language, that's not something I think we're going to find in animals.
Yeah. So you're obviously most known for your primate work, but I read that towards later in your career, you worked a fair bit with elephants as well. And that's something I know a little bit less about your work with as well. So for me and the listeners, what are some of the like most interesting things you find in behavioral and emotional study of elephants?
The elephant work started with the mirror test. Elephants had not passed the mirror test, and so they were said to be not self-aware. I think all animals have some self-awareness. But anyway, that was the claim. The elephants had been tested with a relatively small mirror that was at their foot level. And so I don't know what they saw. They saw some feet moving through the mirror. So we did a new test, first in New York and later in Thailand, with Josh Plotnick, who's the pioneer of that. And we gave them a big mirror that they could access. And all of a sudden, some elephants passed the mirror test. So they belonged to the category of self-aware animals, according to some people. And then later we got interested in their social behavior, their cognition. Their cognition is, since they are so olfactory oriented, you can give an elephant a bucket with, let's say, sunflower seeds and a bucket without sunflower seeds. And by smell, of course, he can detect which one he wants. He wants the sunflower seeds. But he can also detect differences like 100 seeds versus 80 seeds, something that you cannot do. And so the elephant has an extremely sharp sense of olfaction. And we got interested in that sort of things too. But my main interest with the elephants was empathy. Do they console each other after problems when one of them is distressed? And yes, elephants do that kind of thing.
I went on safari to Kenya recently, and the guide we had was telling me an anecdote. She was explaining the similar principle about how their sense of olfaction is so strong. And she had this one particular elephant, which there was a bad encounter with. She had to like drive away and it was pretty dangerous. And ever since it was always super problematic if she would ever to run into that elephant. And, she stopped wearing a certain perfume and changed perfume. And after that point, there was no issues with the elephant anymore. And it treated her like a,
Their sense of smell is 100 times better than that of a dog, and a dog is 100 times better than us. So you can imagine how that is. Yeah.
Wow. Is it true that they have a very good memory as well, or is that just a myth?
I think they have a very good memory. They're very dangerous in the zoos, for example. Most people killed at zoos, caretakers, are killed by elephants. And I think it's because the elephant remembers certain things that these people may have done. That's my guess.
Yeah. I mean, regarding morality and elephants, I saw one of your experiments with the one of pulling the rope. I was wondering if you could explain that experiment for our listeners, the one where you have two elephants that are supposed to lift something together, and then you have one of the elephants that just puts its foot on it.
Yeah. The traditional test is you have a heavy box with food, and a single individual cannot pull it in with a rope. Yeah. You need two individuals to do it. That's the traditional one. For elephants, it's very hard to design a box that is too heavy for one elephant. And so you have a rope that runs through the box, and if only one elephant picks it up, he pulls the rope out, basically. If mm-hmm. two elephants pick it up, they can pull the box towards themselves. And in some of these experiments, there were some smart individuals who, without doing any pulling, would put their foot on the rope, let the other one do all the pulling. So, yeah, elephants are very creative in that regard.
Brilliant.
So what conclusions did you come to more overall in terms of, you said you were particularly interested in whether they console each other or not and how that relates to empathy. Uh-huh. What conclusions did you ultimately come to about the, let's say, their moral system?
Yeah, so the empathy studies, they started with chimps, but then they spread to all sorts of other species. We now have empathy studies in rodents, quite a few, neuroscience studies. We know that oxytocin is involved. So the empathy of mammals, for birds it's a bit more difficult, but for mammals, the empathy is very similar across the board between humans and rodents. It's a very old system of reacting to the emotions of others and reacting to the distress of others. And so the elephant fits in there, but it's not the only species. There's all sorts of, for example, there's studies on dogs where a person in the family is going to cry and then see how the dogs react. And dogs will lick your face and put their head in your lap, and dogs will react to people who are distressed. So there's all sorts of studies now.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because whenever I, even not actual fighting, but like whenever me and my mom, I get into a heated conversation or even shout at each other at a point, just over silly stuff like whose turn it is to clean the kitchen, you'll find that the dog starts to bark as well and might sometimes come and scratch my leg, for example, or even try to protect me or protect my sister or that kind of thing. And it's amazing how that works. And yeah, but just to come to a close, because we don't want to keep you too long, and we're really grateful for the time you've given us. We were wondering if you had any concluding thoughts for our listeners.
Well, the concluding thought is that, and I'm writing about that at the moment, is that it's amazing to me that when I was a student, animals were machines. Animals were stimulus response machines. And if you said animals have emotions, people would frown at you and accuse you. If you said animals can think, animals can feel, animals have some level of awareness, all of that was nonsense and could not be said. And if you said it, you would not be successful as a scientist because people would reject you. And now, let's say 50 years later, if I would go up to an audience, and because I give a lot of lectures, and I would say, animals lack emotions. They may look like they have them, but they don't feel anything. I think I would be booed out of the room. Yeah, people would not accept that at all. There's such a revolution in our thinking going on, and it has, of course, also ethical consequences. I feel that if we recognize the sentience of animals, which we do more and more, there's an obligation to treat them better. I'm not a vegetarian. I'm not necessarily against eating meat, but the meat that we eat needs to be treated a lot better. So the animals are now locked up in very small spaces, like the pigs. That's just not acceptable. We need to give them better lives, even if we eat them in the end.
Yeah, thank you. And I think that's a closing note that Ollie will be very fond to hear. Ollie's a vegan. And I mean, we've spoken to lots of vegan advocates on this podcast, like Peter Singer, Mike the Vegan. But it's a good note to close on. And it's a good thought to leave our listeners with. I myself have also considered vegetarianism, veganism. It's interesting when you realize the morality that animals can hold and the kind of sentience within them, it it makes you think twice when
well,
eating them.
We could at least reduce the meat consumption. People eat far more meat than they will ever need. And so if most people would reduce their meat consumption by 50%, they would still be perfectly healthy. And look at what that would do to the agricultural industry. That would be a major step forward.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to say on that. But again, we don't want to keep you too long. We're really happy to have had you today. And thank you for joining us, Franz. For those listening, please like, subscribe. Franz, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This has been the Loaf Podcast, signing off.